Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, who posted after the debate that Chris Wallace didn't get it on the national debt in a politically biased question, and imagined in a column last week what a Hillary Clinton and Paul Ryan run Washington might be like after Donald Trump presumably loses, assuming Democrats don't take the House as well. We'll talk about those things now. Hi, Dr. Krugman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
Let me start with Paul Ryan, who wrote about who you wrote about as wrongly becoming a media darling because of some, dissension from Donald Trump, but having an almost equally dark vision of Hillary Clinton as president to Donald Trump. You wrote, what was this Paul Ryan speech you wrote about?
Okay, well, he was basically saying that she's going to, that she's going to destroy all incentives. She's going to make America cold and joyless, and everyone will become drones doing what the bureaucrats tell them to do. It was very much, it was more or less his standard line, but a little more graphic than usual. And basically, if you, as a teenage boy, read Atlas Shrugged, which I'm afraid to say I did, it was very much like something out of an Ayn Rand novel. Really a hard thing to imagine given how fairly moderate what she's actually proposing is.
You mean Ayn Rand, who Paul Ryan has said he's a disciple of for her hyper-free market philosophy. And you know he said he only isn't an Ayn Rand disciple anymore because she was for abortion rights.
That's right. She was anti-religion, actually, and he's now making a big show, as one must in the modern Republican Party, of being a godly man. But in terms of everything else, he's very clearly just echoing that vision, which is pretty well. You know, there's an old joke that says that teenage boys often get hung up either on Lord of the Rings or on Atlas Shrugged, and one of those books, leaves you with a distorted view of human motivations, a totally unrealistic view of what life is about, and the other one is about orcs. So,
right. I could see at least two versions of a Clinton-Ryan era playing out. In one, they're both so horrified by Trump's destructive campaign that they come together and get some things done for the good of the country in a new bipartisanship. In the other, this President Clinton proposes some centrist reforms like the first President Clinton tried to do and like President Obama tried to do, like Obama's cap and trade and the individual mandate, which, as you know, were Republican market-based ideas.
Sure.
And Ryan leads a new obstructionist Congress like John Boehner and Newt Gingrich did in their times. Do you think either one of those scenarios, the bipartisan one or the obstructionist one, is likely?
Well, I think the bipartisan one is really a fantasy. I mean, it's a fantasy both about Paul Ryan, the individual. I mean, this notion that he's moderate and willing to reach across the aisle, he has never actually done that. He has never actually shown any willingness to sacrifice anything in his agenda. He's never made any proposal that would give up something in return for getting something he wants. So the notion that he's going to be a bipartisan force, I think, is entirely based on him coming across as non-threatening, but if you look at his actual track record, there's no reason to believe that. And then beyond that, the Tea Party, the extremist wing of House Republicans, is, if anything, likely to be stronger after the election, because to the extent the Democrats gain seats, it'll be the extremists who are left. They're the ones who are in the safe districts. So he wouldn't even be able, even if he were a different person from who every indication is he really is, he wouldn't be able to make those accommodating moves. Some of the people who actually game these things out are in serious doubts that he will last as Speaker, even if Republicans do hold the House, which they probably will.
Because more of the Trump-supporting wing and Tea Party wing might overthrow him. So that's a pretty dour view of what the prospects for policy success of a President Hillary Clinton would be like. Can you put any more positive, spin on the possible future?
Well, if Democrats take the Senate, then Democrats get to appoint a fifth Supreme Court justice, and they have a majority on the Supreme Court, which means that the court will not block reasonable uses of executive action. And what we've been seeing in the last 2 years of the Obama administration is quite a lot of effective policy being done based on existing legislation. Especially the most important place is environmental, where the EPA, we've set things up reasonably so that not every detailed regulation needs to involve a separate piece of legislation. The EPA has a general ability to take measures to control pollution, and that offers a lot of scope for. We've already seen a lot of action on automotive emissions, on truck emissions, and we have a plan that's already laid out, but is hanging in the balance until the Supreme Court has resolved, which is the Clean Power Plan that would do a lot for emissions from coal-fired electric power plants, a huge step on the environment. So if Democrats take the Senate, then a Clinton administration can be quite effective, at least on some areas of policy, mm-hmm. despite complete obstruction from a Republican House.
I know you've been critical that climate change was a missing issue from all three debates. And we know Trump has labeled climate change a hoax and embraces fossil fuels aggressively. He's a joke on this issue. But Clinton also said, as revealed by WikiLeaks, that she wants to defend our pipeline infrastructure against environmental protesters, defend fracking under the right conditions, and that the more radical environmentalists who come to talk to her need to get a life, a direct quote. How concerned are you by that?
I don't think those things are at all in conflict. I mean, it's showing she's an establishment politician who believes in, for the most part, in doing things within the system, and we knew that. If you're shocked by that, you really weren't paying attention. But there's no real conflict between those things and pursuing a strong environmental agenda. Fracking in principle could be a pro-environmental thing. It's lower carbon emissions than other fossil fuels, and it also, for kind of technical reasons, peak load capacity, it helps to ease the transition away basically to a no-coal future. So now the trouble is, as it's actually conducted, it's not very good. So the question is whether there's effective regulation. But those should not be the test case. The real question is the Clean Power Plan and things like that. Are you prepared to phase out the use of coal to generate electricity? That's the most important thing right now. And all indications are that she pretty much is.
As I read the Clinton campaign issue page on global warming, and we did a segment on it comparing Clinton and Trump, which, again, is no comparison, but her page has proposals for big federal investments in getting renewable energy going faster, but she's got no carbon tax or cap and trade or other carbon limiting policy per se. Do you know of more?
The point is that cap and trade is not going to happen, unfortunately. Carbon tax is definitely not going to happen. I wish it could, but look, what I learned from talking to people who are serious about environmental economics is that the standard economic, the economist thing is, well, we have to put a price on this stuff. If we don't have a carbon tax or a cap and trade, which is broadly equivalent, that's we don't have the right policy. But it turns out that global warming is simpler than people think. It's really not hundreds of different things, all of which have to be dealt with. The lion's share of where the changes should be made are in coal-fired electricity generation and methane and a few other high impact gases, so that direct regulation, something that basically provides a really strong incentive to build no more coal-fired plants and phase out the ones we have, is most of what you should be doing. So I don't think none of these things needs to be a litmus test. It doesn't have to be. If you're not for a carbon tax, you're not going to take effective action. The plans the Obama administration has on the table and is basically waiting for a favorable Supreme Court are already a really big step in the right direction.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman with us for another few minutes. You wrote about the national debt question in the debate Wednesday being an editorial on the part of Fox News moderator Chris Wallace, not based on the facts. What did he do that you objected to?
Well, the thing that was an editorial was where he said, well, the Obama stimulus led to slow growth. Not only is that, that should be disputable, and in fact, the evidence is overwhelmingly against it. The evidence is that the stimulus helped a lot while it was in practice, and the problem was it phased out too soon. So he was parroting basically a right-wing line that very few economists who really work on this stuff believe. So that was really bad. I mean, it was just stating as fact something that is not only not fact, but in fact is untrue. And then on the national debt, the idea, look, when we talk about these debt issues, we talk about Social Security, Medicare, and there is indeed a question, you know, how exactly are we going to pay for these programs 20, 30 years from now as the population ages? But is that really a question that has to be dealt with right now? I mean, on Social Security in particular, the warning is that, you know, we might have to cut future benefits or raise taxes at some point in the future to pay for it. And the proposals that are supposed to deal with are plans that, cut benefits gradually over time. So in order to avoid future cuts in benefits, we cut future benefits. It doesn't actually make sense. There's no reason to believe that this is an urgent thing to do right now. And by contrast, global warming, every year that we don't take action, we are, you know, making the problem much, much worse by pouring greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So that the idea that we've had now in the four debates, including the vice presidential, that we've had four questions about the national debt, all of them coming from, you know, the debt scolds from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, that we've had four questions about this basically second-order issue and not one about the defining crisis of our time. That's just awesome.
So one follow-up on this. You're a big Clinton supporter. But again, are you worried about what she might do regarding senior entitlements and the deficit based on the WikiLeaks revelation that she said she embraces the basic Simpson-Bowles debt reduction model? You've been critical of that model as unnecessarily raising the retirement age for Social Security or otherwise cutting benefits.
Well, I could be. Maybe I'm being too complacent, but I actually think things have moved on quite a lot there. And there was a time, I was furious about it, but there was a time when to be respectable in political circles, you had to say nice things about Simpson-Bowles. And I thought, and I'm afraid she may have fallen into that. Look, it's not, if you wanted someone who is completely defiant against the orthodoxy of the time, Hillary Clinton is not your person. That sounded to me, for what it's worth, maybe I'm cutting a lot of slack here, but that sounded to me like somebody basically just trying to sound like someone business people can talk to. Didn't sound like a real passionate commitment. And now, given the politics of Social Security and all of that within the Democratic Party, I don't think you need to worry about that at all.
And I should say that in your column today, you take on the notion that Clinton may just be the lesser of two evils, as opposed to someone who might be a really, really good president.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, aside from, well, you know, someone who actually understands policy, can talk about it coherently, someone who is obviously incredibly cool and self-possessed under pressure, that's kind of what you would like in the White House, right? As opposed to somebody who you'd like to have a beer with, although I actually suspect she is somebody you'd like to have a beer with. But anyway, that's not the point. The virtues she's been showing. She's not a great speaker, no question. She's not somebody who, you know, certainly who men feel chummy with. Although, you know, as I said, she does seem to be actually warmer than people imagine. But she has the kind of character that you would feel relatively safe having her sitting in the Oval Office as stuff goes on in the world. So, gosh, it's amazing actually that when we think of I think there's a lot of unconscious sexism in the way that way too many political commentators imagine you define the talents of someone who is presidential.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, thanks for having a virtual beer with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Stay tuned.